This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. When Martha Stewart sold her shares in the biotech company ImClone a year and a half ago, she earned $229,000, a lot of money for most people, but a drop in the bucket for a multimillionaire businesswoman. Somehow, that drop generated wave after wave of trouble, and more is likely on the way. Yesterday, the domestic entrepreneur resigned as chairman and chief executive of the company that bears her name, after federal prosecutors in New York charged her with obstruction of justice, conspiracy, securities fraud, and lying to investigators. In addition to those criminal charges, the Securities and Exchange Commission has filed a civil charge of insider trading. In response, Martha Stewart took out a full-page ad in today's issues of USA Today, where she proclaims her innocence and vows to fight to clear her name. So what exactly is she supposed to have done? What is insider trading? How does it work? And why can receiving a hot stock tip be a crime? We'll also discuss stockholder rebellions against gargantuan CEO salaries and why corporate reform is so difficult. If you have questions about insider trading or securities fraud, give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And joining us now to talk about the charges filed yesterday against Martha Stewart is Andy Serwer, editor-at-large at Fortune magazine. He's on the way to the airport in Greensboro, North Carolina, and we appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks, Neil.
Run down the charges against Martha Stewart for us. There are criminal and civil charges. Lay them out.
Yeah, interesting stuff here as you sort of break them down one by one, Neil. You know, basically, just to take a step back, what Martha Stewart is accused of doing here is conducting insider trading and then conducting a cover-up and then lying to investigators. As you mentioned, the insider trading charges are part of a civil suit brought by the SEC, and the reason that is being held by the SEC or being pursued by the SEC is because the burden of proof is less. The U.S. Attorney's Office did not think that it had enough evidence, I don't believe, to go after it in terms of it being a criminal matter. When you talk about the criminal charges she's faced with, they're really pretty interesting. The obstruction would be one element, and that has to do with as simple as altering a phone message from her broker, Peter Bakanovic. Investigators say that it said that it gave detail about the CEO of ImClone selling stock. She apparently or allegedly altered it to be a more generic message. The lying to investigators is as simple as that. She said, I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't engage in insider trading. They consider that lying. And probably the most interesting point, Neil, is the matter of fraud. And this is a really almost novel thing to me. Basically, last June, Martha Stewart issued press releases and told newspaper reporters that she was innocent of insider trading. And what that did is it shored up the stock price of her own stock, Martha Stewart OmniMedia, making that stock go up because people concluded that, well, if Martha Stewart's saying she's innocent, by golly, she must be, and that must mean her company's in good stead.
Isn't that almost like being charged for trying to defend yourself?
Yeah, that's what her lawyers are saying. I mean, to me, that's a very, very complex matter. And you know, defending yourself, in other words, you certainly should be able to say that, and I think it sort of almost presumes guilt before innocence, doesn't it?
Yeah. Now, have you ever heard of that charge before?
I haven't. I mean, I'm not a securities lawyer, but it certainly is not very common. I mean, I've been covering Wall Street for 17 years, and I've never heard of it.
Well, there are a lot of questions about this case. Our number again is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address again, TOTN@NPR.org. And let's go to Bob, who's with us from Mountain View, California.
Hi. You know, it seems to me that there is no criminal conspiracy that she's being charged with. She's being sued in a civil suit. And from what I understand of contract law, I mean, this is no connection, but that you have to have a gain in order in a contract to be sued for something. She lost money. But anyway, I mean, there is no criminal conspiracy. She's being charged with, at one point, quote unquote, having a document where the email wasn't there, it was just the title. That's a criminal conspiracy.
Well,
that's a criminal act.
Could I respond to that, Neil?
Yes, please.
Yeah, Bob, I think, first of all, I think that she did make money on the stock trade. So number one. But I do agree with some of what you're saying. In other words, they're trying to say she engaged in a cover-up of something, of a matter they haven't found her guilty of, and in fact didn't even see enough evidence to indict her on, which is the insider trading. But, you know, it's not just the phone message that they're saying that she altered. It's also that she had a conversation with the broker sort of saying, let's get our stories straight. But, again, it is a little bizarre that, you know, they're talking about a cover-up of something that they don't find her, they don't have enough evidence to actually charge her on in terms of criminal.
Can I ask you one question? I understand there was that email message where they only got the title of it that was given at one point is what I've heard. What did they mean at one point? In other words, there was more forthcoming, and she just had just a title at one point, and so she withheld at a freezing, giving more details at some fear. Obviously, that's a story, but at one point, they said. So,
well, you know, I'm not exactly sure what that means either, but I'll tell you. I mean, how many times have all of us altered emails for different reasons? I mean, you're forwarding something on to your cousin, and you don't want this part. In other words, there could be all kinds of reasons why you would alter the subject line in an email. I mean, it doesn't look good. It looks fishy in this circumstance. But remember, I mean, you've got to be proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt here.
Can I make one more point?
Well, Bob, I was just going to explain also that reading legal briefs can make you a little nauseous at times. The language is awfully contorted sometimes.
You know, I think I can put in a nutshell what the feeling is out there. You have Enron that gave millions upon millions, had a whole organization. You had an SEC chairman under Clinton who wanted to reform the bookkeeping practices, and not only did the Republicans not want to do it, but they didn't want to have campaign finance reform that encouraged Democrats to go along with laws that made things wide open. And after billions of dollars of losses, they're going after this lady for an email that wasn't complete, that she only gave partial at one point. Now, I think I can put in a nutshell some of the feeling that's out there. That's all. I'll leave it on the air.
Okay, Bob. Okay. Thanks very much for the call, but there may be a little bit more behind these allegations than just that email.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, there are a whole manner of things, and there are also probably things that we don't know that aren't necessarily laid out, Neil, in terms of, you know, her saying one thing to investigators and then something else actually being true. But I understand people's frustrations, and I'm talking to a lot of people all over the country, and they're sort of echoing what Bob is saying, is that look at all the Enron crooks and the people at WorldCom and Global Crossing and Adelphi and Tyco, and how come people haven't been indicted there when shareholders lost billions of dollars, and yet you have this one high-profile celebrity woman who is now indicted?
And that's a good question. On the other hand, she is a high-profile celebrity woman who, if she wasn't indicted, what? How do you get around that?
I think that's also a very valid point. Investigators would certainly not want to look like they were soft-peddling Martha Stewart. I mean, the point of the matter is this. If a police officer catches you going 85 miles an hour, and you say, look, everyone else is going 110 miles an hour, and the police officer says, too bad, you're speeding.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're breaking the law, you're breaking the law.
Now, remind us again about ImClone and the activities that led all up to all of this. You wrote a profile of ImClone CEO Sam Wachsell last year.
That's correct. This goes back to December of 2001. It's been this long. The company was waiting for a critical decision by the Food and Drug Administration having to do with its cancer drug called Erbitux, which, by the way, ironically, has received some favorable reviews lately.
Yeah, it's been doing pretty well.
Yes. Back then, though, it got a very bad review from the FDA, and everyone, shareholders, were anxiously awaiting that because the whole fortune of the company depends on that. Apparently, Sam Wachsell, the CEO of ImClone, got wind of the FDA decision and dumped a lot of stock. He had his daughter dump a lot of stock, and they shared, Sam Wachsell and Martha Stewart shared a broker, this Peter Bukanovic individual, and Bukanovic had his assistant tip off Martha Stewart, allegedly, and Martha Stewart allegedly sold her stock because of this young assistant tipping her off.
Let's go get some more callers, and joining us now is Jeremy, who's with us from Howell, Michigan.
Hi, Neil. Great show.
Thanks.
I just had a question, and this kind of relates to the airlines involved in the 9/11 also. I was wondering if you could clarify the definitions of put and sell options and how they relate to this case.
Well, Jeremy, I don't really think that there are any options involved in this particular case with regard to Imclin and Martha Stewart. I think that the Waxel family may have had some options involved. But with Martha Stewart, it was simply that she owned the stock of ImClone, and she sold it. And when the FDA made that announcement that was negative about Erbitux, the ImClone stock dropped precipitously. And so she saved herself from getting hit with a big loss.
There was something in the case, though, called a stop-loss order, which is either was or wasn't involved here.
Yes, a stop-loss order. That's different from options, though. The stop-loss order would be you have instructions that you give to your broker, Neil, simply telling him or her to sell the stock if it ever reaches a certain level. In other words, the stock goes down to 60, the broker is instructed to sell it no matter what. Now, she has suggested that she had a stop-loss order with the broker Bakanovic. However, and I just found this piece of information fascinating, they had a record, supposedly, but the investigators are saying that the record, the number 60 that Bakanovic wrote on the piece of paper, was an ink that was scientifically distinguishable from other ink on the paper.
Oh, there's a new CSI show coming.
Isn't that exactly? Isn't that a nice phrase, scientifically distinguishable?
And so he's been indicted as well.
Absolutely, he has.
All right. Let's go now to Mark, who's with us from Exeter, New Hampshire.
Yes, good afternoon. My question was, with Martha Stewart's resignation, is she basically plugging a finger into a hole in a sinking ship, or is it a strategic move on her part to possibly save the stock value of her company, or was she possibly forced out? Is this some sort of, you know, do you think it's some sort of strategic move on her part or on her attorney's part?
And by her company, that's Martha Stewart Living, OmniMedia.
Right, and I think that's a really fascinating issue. One thing that people forget is, you know, the board of the company of Martha Stewart OmniMedia has an obligation to protect its shareholders, and Martha Stewart works for the board. And the board is not a bunch of patsies in this case, as you might think. Even though Martha Stewart is the brand, the CEO, and the majority shareholder, Arthur Martinez, the former CEO of Sears, is on the board. A very powerful banker named Darla Moore is on the board as well. And in fact, previously there was talk of removing Martha Stewart. So the board has an obligation to shareholders, and they might have told Martha Stewart, look, you have to go here. I mean, you've been indicted. And you're right to suggest that Martha is also looking to help herself out because, you know, she's a large shareholder. She's in the same boat as all the other stockholders of the company. So it'll be really interesting to see how she's able to maintain herself, if she can, as the brand itself of this company, as she's indicted and faces this investigation, possible trial, possible jail time, and possible fine.
It was interesting at the end of Jeffrey Toobin's profile of Martha Stewart in the New Yorker some weeks ago. She says, quit a business that's my life? Impossible.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you know, right now she's what, chief creative director, I think, is her new title. But, you know, the new CEO, Sharon Patrick's a long-time protege of hers. And, I mean, there certainly will be discussions back and forth as to the direction of the company, won't there?
I suspect there may be. Mark, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break now. And when we come back, we'll move beyond the Martha Stewart case in specific and talk about insider trading in general, what it is, how it works. And we'll take more of your calls at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After charges were filed yesterday against Martha Stewart, we're talking about insider trading, what it is, how it works, what the penalties are. Later in the program, we'll also talk about insider selling, very different phenomenon from insider trading. We'll talk about what it is and why some investors think that inside selling is the best way to gauge a company's prospects. But back to insider trading. If you have questions, give us a call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address, totn@npr.org. Still with us is Andy Serwer, editor-at-large at Fortune Magazine. And joining us now from his office is Joel Seligman, the dean of the Washington University Law School in St. Louis, Missouri. He's the author of 19 books, including The Transformation of Wall Street, A History of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and Modern Corporate Finance. And welcome.
It's good to be with you.
Now, explain to us, if you would, Mr. Seligman, what is insider trading?
When certain individuals, typically corporate officers or directors, buy or sell stock on the basis of material, which means important non-public information, they can violate laws. And the notion is very simply this. If, let's say, a CEO like Sam Wachsell knows that the favorable result from the Food and Drug Administration isn't going to come before it's been publicly disclosed, he can sell his stock and avoid a major loss. And by doing so, you undermine public confidence that we've got fair markets, markets on which basically both insiders and outsiders are trading with more or less the same kind of information.
How common is this? I mean, most of us don't exactly travel in the social circles of corporate CEOs, but can anybody be the recipient of an inside tip?
Yes. Literally, the law reaches, quote, any person. There's a complicated case called SEC versus Dirks from 1983, where it basically says the tip has to have been made in violation of a fiduciary duty, and the person who receives it has to have a certain level of knowledge of the violation. But in this case, it's alleged you had a kind of daisy chain, beginning with Wachsell, going to Bakunovich, ultimately going to Martha Stewart. And if it's possible to prove each link in the chain, it's a pretty standard insider trading case.
Andy Serwer, obviously we're all focused on this case now, but are there other celebrated cases in Wall Street history?
Yeah, there have been all kinds of cases. It happens all the time. The SEC probably does about 50 cases of these a year. It's a very gray thing, though. Let me give you an example. Say you know someone who works for Colgate toothpaste. And this person says, you know, we really have a great new kind of toothpaste coming out. That's probably fairly innocent. And then you go into the internet and read toothpaste news magazine online, and it says, yes, in fact, it is, and the people at Crest are concerned about it. You go out and buy Colgate stock, and it goes up. That's probably not insider trading. Here's an example of how it would be insider trading. You know a guy who works at Colgate, and he says, don't tell anyone about this. It's totally secret. We've never told anyone about this new toothpaste. This toothpaste is going to revolutionize the business, but it's totally secret and hasn't been revealed yet.
Hmm.
And then you go home and buy Colgate Palmolive stock. That very well may be insider trading.
Well, Joel Seligman, these are pretty fine areas.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But in this case, if the allegations are proven, you're dealing with the exact flip case that Andy just described. You're dealing with a company which basically was betting the mortgage money on Erbitux. It became clear they weren't going to get the FDA approval they wanted. It became clear that a communication was made by Sam Wachsell to his attorney, which raises real legal questions, and rather to the broker. And it's alleged that the broker then communicated the substance of sell orders from Wachsell. Those allegations, if proved, are not marginal or gray. They're pretty plain vanilla violations of securities laws.
What do you make of the fact that the insider trading accusations are now civil charges where, you know, it's only the preponderance of evidence, it's not beyond a reasonable doubt?
I'm not sure that's the reason for it. The Justice Department is very experienced at dealing with counts like perjury and obstruction of justice and conspiracy. The SEC is very experienced bringing insider trading cases. And in a certain way, they may have divvied up the cases based upon their respective expertises.
All right. Well, let's get another listener involved. Steve joins us on the line from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hi, Neil. I've got a question. I don't really understand how somebody can get accused of insider trading by getting information from their broker. If my broker, for a change, actually gives me good information, how am I concerned where he gets it, and how concerned do I need to be in terms of where he got his information? I'll listen off the air.
Okay, thanks for the call, Steve. Joel?
if your broker calls up and says, I've got a hot tip, or if he calls up and says, I've been doing research, you got no concerns. If your broker calls up and says, I was just speaking to the CEO of the company, and he's totally devastated, this company's product line is going down the tubes, let's get out before it's publicly announced, that's insider information.
I mean, a hot tip, just to follow up on that, Joel, a hot tip should be your broker or someone's broker, you doing research, you interpreting data better, you digging deeper better, you going places and figuring things out better than other people out there. But, you know, when you get information from a company that is not public and you know it, you're really in a danger zone. And, you know, people ask me this all the time, and a lot of times I say, well, what do you think? Do you feel a little bad about this? Do you think that it's kind of suspicious? Do you think you could be subject to an investigation? And if someone says, well, kind of, I said, do yourself a favor. Don't do it.
Andy, I know you've got to run to catch a plane, but before you do, I wanted to ask you, do you think, given all the publicity around this, that there's now a general perception that this is the way Wall Street works, that if you know the right people, this sort of thing goes on all the time?
I think a lot of people do think that, and I think to a certain extent they're right. I think, but you know, nothing brings out the crooks and the people who like shortcuts more than a bull market. And that's what happened in the 1990s. It was easy money. There was whispering going on. You know, people overlooked this kind of activity because everyone was making money. And now that things have fallen apart, well, people are starting to point fingers. And, you know, what kind of insider trading and hot tips are there when the market's going down? So I think it's a little bit having to do with the times. But I do think people think that, and I think they're right to a certain extent.
Andy Serwer, again, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Andy Serwer is editor-at-large at Fortune magazine and wrote a profile of M-Clone CEO Sam Wachsell called The Socialite Scientist for the April 15th, 2002 issue, and he was with us as he was racing to get a plane in Greensboro, North Carolina. Still with us is Joel Seligman, the dean of the Washington University School of Law in St. Louis, and we have an email question from Judy Gardner in Rochester, New York. I was a secretary at a manufacturing firm that was bought out. The new parent company offered employees stock purchasing. On my limited salary, I bought the maximum shares I was allowed. I figured who would know better than someone who works here how this company's doing. Isn't that the equivalent to having insider information? What if I had tons of money and bought shares on the open market? I could easily have been privy to information that would affect our stock price.
If you have a regular contractual plan to buy stock and you're committed to it regardless of whether you know anything special, regardless of whether the company is doing bad or doing good, you're protected from insider trading prosecutions. There's a recently adopted SEC rule which establishes that. The thing that I think is really important to appreciate is that the kind of insider trading that can either get you sent to jail or subject you to major sanctions and penalties is not everyday simple information. It is unique information. It's what we call material. It has to be something that, on average, will push a stock price maybe 5% in one direction or another, although there are certain exceptions to that. It is like the kind of information you saw, for example, in the Martha Stewart case, where the stock price jumped 16% or it fell 16% one day. And when you're dealing with that kind of unusual material event, the insider trading laws kick in.
Okay, let's go now to Adam, who's on the line with us from Miami, Florida.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
How you doing?
Okay.
That's a quick question about the insider trading in general. Does insider trading apply also to family members and also to significant others or, you know, wives, girlfriends, you know, that sort of thing? If somebody has information and your spouse say they know something about it and they're selling and you're going to sell too, is this considered violation of the law?
And that certainly comes up in this case, doesn't it, Joel Seligman?
It does. There's a daughter involved with Wachsell. Yes, it frequently will apply in those cases. It frequently can apply to other family members as well. You get into somewhat more attenuated circumstances where you have a relative who's not living at home and so forth. But the conventional spouse situation or child living in the same house is consistently been covered by these kind of prosecutions.
So you can't pillow talk counts, Adam.
Mum's the word.
Mum's the word.
Thanks. All right, thank you.
Thanks very much. It must be extremely difficult. Now, all kinds of people in all kinds of walks of life are asked to, you know, contain secrets that just want to burst out of them. But this kind of stuff is just going to be very difficult not to tell people whose financial future is at risk, particularly if you love them.
Well, it's okay to tell them. They just can't trade. What we're dealing with is what's called the disclose or abstain rule, and no one's trying to say you can't talk to a spouse or someone with whom you live or what have you, but the person isn't allowed to take advantage of the inside information.
Let's go now to Thomas, who's another caller from Miami.
Yes, hi, Neil.
Hi.
My question is this. I've never really understood the idea of insider trading. I've always thought it's sort of a contrivance, and this is my example. I worked at an internet company. That was it was doing very well, and of course, like most internet companies, it started to, you know, plummet in the 2000s. I was going to sell all the options that I had, which is about, I don't know, 5,000 shares, and I came across private inside information that we were definitely going to do very poorly. But I was going to sell the stock anyway. So, you know, my colleagues and I were wondering, like, now that we have this private information, are we forced to not sell the stock? Meaning, sort of, doesn't it depend on what your motivation is for selling it? And what do you do if you have, you know, combined reasons for selling your stock? Does that question make sense?
It makes perfect sense, and it's the kind of situation that comes up all the time. And
right.
When I refer to the disclose or abstain rule, it gives you a pretty simple principle. If there is material information that's going to move the stock price sufficiently, you've got to wait till it's been disclosed. You're not allowed to take advantage of it. The reason for this rule, which has been pretty consistently enforced by the SEC now over four decades, is to try to prevent deteriorating investor confidence in the securities market. We've just been through a period where we saw stock prices fall, you know, something like $7 trillion, and part of the decline is attributed to accounting fraud, to breakdowns in audits, and the notion that investors had lost confidence in the marketplace. Another way they can lose confidence is if they think the insiders are privy to a lot of information that the outsiders are not.
But the problem with that is that if you were going to trade stock anyway, and you come across private inside information, then the access to that information will prevent you from trading?
If you've already sent in the sell order, it doesn't prevent you. If you've got a long-standing program to liquidate your holdings over a period of time, it doesn't prevent you. If, for example, to paraphrase Martha Stewart's defense here, you have a limit order and she can prove it, and it was entered long before she learned anything about Sam Wachsell's selling intentions, I'm not sure she's violated the law. But the key is it really has to precede the acquisition of the inside information.
Thanks, Thomas.
Thank you.
And we're talking with Joel Seligman, the Dean of Washington University School of Law, about insider trading, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email question from Edwin Okongo. Is there a statute of limitation in insider trading crimes?
There is a statute of limitation under the criminal laws. It's a basic 5-year period of time.
5 years.
Yes.
All right. Let's go to Ahmed, who joins us on the line from San Francisco.
Hi.
Hi.
Let's say that you have a bunch of stock and you have the potential to lose quite a bit of money if the price of the stock were to go down. And you get some information, maybe it's from your broker and it's possible insider trading, or maybe you know for a fact that you have some inside information. What are you supposed to do? You're supposed to just sit and watch all your money disappear?
Kind of contrary to human nature, isn't it, Ahmed?
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, it doesn't happen that way very often. Brokers do a lot of research. Brokers, in many instances, will look at the overall state of the economy or look at the overall state of the industry. But to actually have information of value given to a specific broker by specific insiders is really relatively rare.
So the other thing to point out, Ahmed, is if you've got a whole bunch of stock, you're always at risk of losing a whole bunch of money. Yeah. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Here's an email from Keith. Doesn't this just lay bare a fundamental flaw in the system of trading stocks? I realize there are serious charges facing Ms. Stewart, fraud, obstruction, but as for the insider trading, isn't it true that some people will always have better information with which to trade their stocks? What is the working definition of insider trading, and when does a tip become a crime?
Great questions.
and to take them up in order. First, some people always will be better at trading than others. Some people will always be shrewder in interpreting data. What you bring to the party, your analytical abilities, are not crimes. What takes analytical abilities and crosses the line to crimes is when typically you have specific very good information or very bad information. You really don't have to analyze it. It's often presented to you on a silver plate. It's something like the FDA isn't going to approve the drug, or the stock dividend is going to double or be cut in half. And you trade on that basis before there's a public announcement. And it's the notion that if you're allowed to trade on information that is not the result of your genius or analysis, but just the result of being inside a corporation before it's been publicly disseminated, you're going to reduce the public's confidence that they can trade in a fair market.
Let's get a question now from Steve, who's with us from Baltimore.
Yes, I'd like to know, is there tend to be a little bit more, and I don't want to say forgiveness, but less likely prosecution for someone who happens to take advantage of a tip that keeps them from losing a lot of money versus taking advantage of a tip that would make them? And I'm just thinking, if you're an honest person, it's probably pretty easy to ignore a tip that would cause you to buy the stock. You say, okay, I can't. I'd love to make money off it, but I can't. However, if you've got a lot of money invested and you just found out that your stock is going to dive, very hard to sit on that, I would guess, for a lot of people.
I think there have been a very significant proportion of cases of bad news and good news tips. It doesn't seem to have much impact on whether the cases are brought by the SEC or the Justice Department.
Okay.
One factor, though, that does make an enormous difference is when you're not honest with the investigators, whether it's you distort evidence or plead in ways they think involve perjury or try to persuade others to do so. Under those circumstances, the Justice Department tends to come down like a load of bricks.
We're talking about insider trading. When we come back from a break, though, we're going to expand the conversation to take up the issues of corporate reform and shareholder revolt, particularly on the issue of the salaries that are given to many CEOs these days. And also, a little later, we'll find out what insider selling is and why some investors are worried about it. We'll take your calls as well, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This week, if all goes as planned, two spacecraft will head towards Mars. Join Ira Flatow on Science Friday for a look at both missions, plus new results from the Mars Odyssey mission. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today we're talking about corporate reform in the wake of yesterday's indictments against Martha Stewart and in the wake of scandals, Enron, Tyco, the rest. Our phone number is 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. And the email address is totn@npr.org. With us is Joel Seligman, Dean of the Washington University School of Law in St. Louis, author of The Transformation of Wall Street, A History of the Securities and Exchange Commission and Modern Corporate Finance. And Joel, obviously another fallout of the corporate scandals is the rise of shareholder activism. For example, shareholders in Apple Computer voted in April for a resolution that would require the company to expense the stock options it gives its big executives. In the end, though, Apple announced it wouldn't do that, but it expressed its appreciation for shareholder input. What's behind that?
It's been long the case that shareholders are allowed to vote advisory shareholder proposals for action, making recommendations as to how the board should act. Very rarely do they get a majority. And it strikes one as bordering on a kind of arrogance when you see a shareholder proposal for action on a current and important issue of the day receive that large a vote, and in effect just to be fluffed off by the board. Now, the shareholders at this point can, if they choose,
try to replace the board if there's a proxy contest. They can sell their stock. If circumstances warranted, they're also capable of bringing lawsuits. But it's an extraordinary event to see a shareholder majority for one of these proposals and nothing happen.
Mm. At Avon, investors voted to force the company's board of directors to be reelected annually. At Delta Airlines and Kimberly-Clark, they voted to have the companies treat stock options as an expense, same thing as at Apple. And at Hewlett-Packard and Verizon, they voted to curb golden parachutes. There's just a few examples taken from an article in the New Yorker magazine.
What you're seeing right now is angry shareholders. The market is way down. There's been evidence disclosed of major misconduct on the part of some corporate executives and directors, and shareholders want a more accountable system.
Well, why can't they just, you know, if they don't like it, they can leave, sell their stock?
They often do. In fact, that's the easiest and most common reaction, but that also creates pressure for stock prices to fall further.
In which case, they should lose some money there in the transactions. The same article in the New Yorker, and you may not agree with this, the economists, and you're not an economist, but some people found that firms with stronger shareholder rights had faster sales growth, higher profits, and better stock returns than those that shut investors out. Is investor shareholder democracy a good idea?
I think it's a good idea, even if those data are not always true, for the simple reason that it creates an accountability mechanism. It creates a mechanism, in effect, by which you don't have an omnipotent CEO who, as we saw in some recent scandalous instances, can push the corporation in directions it shouldn't go. It's another check and balance.
Let's talk with Maury, who joins us on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Hi. I wanted to ask, you know, what should institutional investors or shareholders in general be asking that boards do to restrict the ability of CEOs to sell off stock the way that Waxell did? I mean, clearly it's such a lack of faith show on his part to dump $4 million worth of stock in a company that he had founded like he did at Mclone. I mean, what can shareholders demand have happen? And why aren't, you know, big, powerful shareholders, like institutional shareholders, asking for these reforms?
I think a lot of them are. And I think sort of in the background is a tremendous movement going on right now to toughen the standards that apply to corporate executives, to strengthen the corporate board, to adopt codes of ethics, to, in many instances, expense stock options, to strengthen the audit review process. In fact, the real question that's evolving is whether we've got so many things that will lead to more reform of the system that there may be a little overkill and you may be chilling legitimate business activity. Now, with respect to the specific question, can you limit CEOs from selling stock in their own company? Clearly, the federal securities laws prevent you from short selling, which is a way to profit from potential declines. Clearly, Sam Waxell was alleged to have sold while in possession of material non-public information. That is illegal. Above and beyond that, though, in a code of ethics, you could, if the board of directors thought it was a wise idea, limit the ability of corporate executives to sell.
Maury, thanks very much.
Well, can I follow up? There's also the notion of, you know, just cozy relationships between members of the board and CEOs, too, in a lot of these early-stage biotech companies, isn't there?
Yeah, there's been a lot of allegations that, you know, members of boards are members of each other's boards, and they're just scratching each other's backs.
Right, trading money and letting each other get away with, you know, with robbing the bank.
It's very difficult to mount successful proxy fights against members of boards of directors, isn't it, Joel?
It is very difficult. It is very rare. And one of the questions, you know, the SEC apparently is now focusing on is whether or not they should make it easier for outside shareholders to nominate potential director candidates. The moment when you circulate a proposal for action under what's called Rule 14A8, the corporation picks up the bill. But if you want to nominate candidates to be on the corporate board of directors, you've got to pick up the bill, and this has discouraged that kind of shareholder activism.
Maury, thanks very much. We just have a couple of minutes left with Joel Seligman, but you brought up the Securities and Exchange Commission, and obviously there's a new commissioner. Harvey Pitt resigned last year under a cloud of controversy over the way he handled corporate scandals. President Bush has appointed William Donaldson to take his place. How's he doing so far?
I think he's doing great. I mean, the most important thing he did was to arrive coincident with a major budget increase. But he's been a calming force within the commission. He's been very supportive of its enforcement efforts. He's focusing, I think, on big picture issues. He's gotten the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board at last off to what looks like a good start as well. So far, so good.
Now, has he been able, a big loss of public confidence amidst all these scandals. Do you think he's been able to repair that, at least in terms of Washington? You got to get it through here and New York first before it spreads out to the rest of the country, right?
I think it's a slow process. I mean, you got to start with a commission, which was pretty demoralized. And a major effort has to be to try to get the commissioners all on the same page, to try to get the staff to feel comfortable with where the agency is going. But he's done a good job, I think, working with Congress. He is clearly going to lead to an agency which has some deterrent punch and will help prevent some of the kind of frauds we saw in the recent past from recurring.
And in the couple of years since these scandals started to erupt, have we seen fundamental reform?
Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002 was the most important federal securities law since the 1930s. It is absolutely fundamental in terms of what it tries to do with the auditing process, some of the aspects with respect to corporate disclosure, what it does with the board of directors, what it does potentially with investment analysts. The key, though, is for a law like this to work, it's got to be enforced. It's not good enough just to enact it. And one of the things that's very impressive about the SEC right now is the Division of Enforcement has clearly been on the job. Clearly has been bringing a lot of cases, initiating a lot of investigations, and I think doing a particularly praiseworthy job.
Joel Seligman, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Joel Seligman, Dean of the Washington University Law School. He's the author of The Transformation of Wall Street, A History of the Securities and Exchange Commission and Modern Corporate Finance, and he spoke with us from his office in St. Louis. Here are some of the headlines today at NPR News. The executive and managing editors of the New York Times have stepped down. Howell Raines and Gerald Boyd submitted their resignations in the wake of the journalistic fraud scandal involving reporter Jason Blair. Also, Attorney General John Ashcroft went to Capitol Hill today to defend the Justice Department's actions in response to the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He told the House Judiciary Committee that no laws were broken in the detention of hundreds of foreigners on immigration violations. You can hear details on both those stories later today on All Things Considered. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.